This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this July 18th edition of Space Talk. If this is your first adventure with us and you are even remotely interested in the space program, then I invite you to stick around for the next hour as we talk about anything and everything having to do with the space program. And this week we continue celebrating the Apollo 11 anniversary 40 years ago this week, the flight in the air right now. And we've got some Kennedy Space Center veterans who will be joining us in just a few moments to talk about their memories of that first lunar landing mission. Thanks to the Apollo 11 anniversary this week, it has been a very busy week when it comes to space news. I want to spend a few moments catching you up on what's going on in space during the past week. Anyway, first I want to update you on how Shuttle Endeavour's mission is going. As you all know, it launched on Wednesday, got off the ground just fine, despite some buzz about some concerns of heat protection material coming off the foam, coming off the external tank, and striking the orbiter. They did a quick look at all of the pictures and the data coming back from the shuttle, and they did the pictures of the shuttle when they docked to the space station. And the bottom line is no concern whatsoever with any of the damage they saw. It was just a few nicks and dings there a little bit. Nothing that's going to require them to do what's called a focused inspection, nothing that's going to require any kind of repair work. Although analysis continues and Endeavour is not officially yet cleared to come back, there is absolutely no reason to believe that that is not going to happen. Right now, in fact, the first of five spacewalks is underway at the International Space Station. 13 people on board that vehicle. Actually, I guess only 11 on board and two outside. Dave Wolf and Timothy Copper are outside the space station right now doing the first spacewalk. It began about 12:20 this afternoon. And the main goal for this spacewalk is installing what we've called the back porch, the exposed experiment rack for the Japanese science module. And again, the reports so far from Mission Control is that all is going well with that spacewalk. They're right on the timeline and not having any problems whatsoever. Other news going on this week, and again related to the moon landing, this week the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that moon probe that launched a few weeks here from the Cape, a few weeks ago, is settling into its orbit, and in fact, it's tested its cameras, and just in time for the anniversary of the landing on Monday night, NASA yesterday released some pictures of the Apollo lunar landing sites, all but one of them, and showed very clearly that, in fact, we were there, and we left stuff up there. The Apollo 11 site, the Apollo 12 site, all showing the base of the lunar module as a little spot on the moon, casting a very long shadow. Because of the orbit that the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter satellite is in, it's kind of an elliptical orbit, so depending on where it was either lower or higher in its orbit when it took these pictures. And so when it actually got down a little bit lower, it happened to be able to photograph the Apollo 14 site, which was the clearest one of the pictures they released. You could actually make out the shape of the descent module of the lunar module, and you could see where they deployed a science instrument, and you could even see tracks in the lunar surface where Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell were pulling a utility cart that they used for moving their instruments around. It was on Apollo 15, the next mission, then the next three that used the lunar rover. And again, we certainly expect to see rover tracks on the moon as this spacecraft settles into its low orbit and takes some more pictures in the near future. Again, that mission not only about the past, but about the future, taking pictures to see where we are going to go back to the moon, the best places to do it, what kind of resources we can use when we get up there. Yesterday, locally, a big day for Apollo. The Spacewalk of Fame folks dedicated the Apollo Monument at Titusville along the Indian River banks. A wonderful ceremony followed by a great picnic of Apollo veterans, Apollo alumni. Charlie Mars and his team did a great job with that monument, joining now the Gemini Monument and the Mercury Monument. And certainly that whole organization deserves a round of applause, some public support, and certainly financial contributions. We can talk about that another time. Meanwhile, up in Washington, Charles Bolden and Lori Garver were confirmed as the top dogs for NASA. Charlie Bolden, a former astronaut, very well loved and respected an outstanding leader, now taking the reins of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Lori Garver, a longtime friend and advocate of the space program, is the deputy, and we wish them luck and certainly hope to have at least one of them on the show in the near future. Another big story last week happened actually last Monday when SpaceX, the company run by Elon Musk, famous for developing PayPal, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with and perhaps use, successfully put their first working satellite for Malaysia into Earth orbit. They launched from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean. This is their second successful launch to orbit, but only the first time they've actually put a working satellite into orbit. They had three failures to start their program. Then they launched a dummy satellite into orbit, and now this is the first successful commercial shot that they're actually going to get revenue for. And why is that a big deal for us here at the Cape or even in the United States? Well, first of all, it is another example of how this new group of commercial space entrepreneurs are doing what they say they're going to do and develop a new, cheaper way to get into orbit. Getting into orbit is a tough thing to do, and Elon's team deserves some credit. They do plan to launch what's called the Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral here. They've got a team here working. The rocket's here. They hope to launch by the end of the year. And again, as we talk about the shuttle retiring, there's great hopes that the Falcon 9 rocket will be one of those that sends cargo and perhaps even one day humans to the International Space Station, that NASA can actually just buy these commercial services off the rack. And, of course, there's lots of competition out there for that work, but the Falcon 1 success boded very well for the Falcon 9 in that the Falcon 9 is just basically a bunch of Falcon 1s strapped together. And that looks good so far, and we wish them luck as well. Finally, as we look back at the news this week, the big news last night that Walter Cronkite passed away at the age of 92, a true space program fixture for the entire nation, an icon in the media business. What can you say? Just incredibly wonderful career that he had. Frequently cited here at the Cape. My last experience with him came in 1998 when he was here for the John Glenn shuttle mission. And a buddy of mine were actually eating dinner. Where would you else eat dinner and run into Walter Cronkite but at Barnard's Surf in Cocoa Beach? And we were sitting there in the kind of the front dining room, and he was out in back and getting ready to go. And he came out, and of course, the minute he came into the main dining room, thunderous applause, spontaneous. Everyone knew exactly who he was, and he spent time talking to people as he walked out. He spent time talking with me. I'd met him before. So Walter's gone. Frank McGee from NBC, Jules Bergman from ABC, all the greats for space now have left us, and but we've got all the good memories of them telling the story of space, and something that certainly inspired me. As a kid growing up in Minnesota, we would watch these TV channels, and these were our connections to the space program. And just wonderful stuff. And there's going to be a lot of specials about him on TV during the next few days. And because of his connection to the space program, a lot of neat old footage of space and his work here at the Cape that I encourage you to keep an eye out for. And so that's kind of the updates on what's going on here in space this past week. Coming up after this next break that we take in just a few moments, we are going to be joined by Dick Bagley, Bob Seek, and Lee Sala. We'll introduce them properly in a moment. But we certainly look forward to talking to them about their memories of Apollo 11 and also hear a little bit about what they've been up to lately. You can join in on all the fun here by getting a hold of us in a number of ways. First of all, giving us a call at 321-768-1240 locally, or locally your AT&T wireless customers can punch in *1240 for a free call right here to the studio. If you have friends outside the Space Coast listening area, give them a call right now. Tell them they can join in and listen online at WMMBAM.com, and you can also send us email at spacetalking@AOL.com. We're monitoring that right now. If you have a question or comment and you want to just send that in by email, feel free to do that. We're going to have more about Apollo 11 in just a moment, and our guests will join us and get on the microphones, and we'll start talking some memories. This is Jim Bankey for Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240 and *1240 for AT&T wireless customers.
During these troubled economic times, you may have questions about your financial future. The experts at FPT Services in Rockledge have the answers. They'll listen to you, develop a custom plan, and work as your partner with a full array of financial and estate planning services. Don't wait for the economy to recover. Call FPT Services in Rockledge at 631-0383. That's 631-0383. Find them online at fptservices.com.
Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Jim Banky, and this is Space Talk on AM 1240 and 1350 WMMB. Encourage all of you right now to get in the queue right now, lining up. Give us a call, 321-768-1240, star 1240 for local AT&T wireless customers. And we'll stand by with your questions and comments. For the three gentlemen I'm going to introduce right now, and I don't even know where to start. How much can I say about these guys? Dick Bagley, Bob Seek, Lee Solid, all veteran engineers who worked at the Kennedy Space Center on the Apollo 11 launch and who all went on from there to become senior program managers, officials, working with the Space Shuttle program. They're all fairly recently retired. And, in fact, when they retired, Dick Bagley was with the United Space Alliance. Lee Solid was with I think it was with Rockwell just before it became part of United Space Alliance, and Bob Seek retiring from NASA. And before we let them actually start telling their stories, I just want you to understand the high caliber of the men that we have here today. All three have earned the Kurt Debus Award from the National Space Club Florida Committee. Now, this award named for the first director of the Kennedy Space Center. The Debus Award is the highest and most prestigious space award any Floridian can get, and all three of them were awarded this award for their contributions and work with the space program. They may be retired, but they're still busy. We'll talk about that in a minute. Now, I guess I should stop and not say anything more, for I don't want to tell their stories. They should tell their own stories on their own. So, Dick, Lee, Bob, welcome to Space Talk.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Okay, Dick, say something first. Let's get everyone's voices so that we can train everyone who to hear.
I'll say something first.
Dick, what are you up to these days?
Right now, I am doing some consulting for Northrop Grumman, working on a proposal for the last big chunk of the Constellation program, which would be the ground processing.
Okay.
And very active in the community, do a lot of fundraising in the community, and I stay very busy.
Hardly retired, right?
Hardly. I've flunked retirement twice.
That's good. Good. Bob, say hello.
Well, and I'd like to say that I am retired. The priorities are children, grandchildren, volunteer work, and hobbies. I do a little bit of consulting work. Some of the volunteer work is with NASA Public Affairs, and I'm a member of the Constellation Program Standing Review Board, an independent assessment board that's looking at what NASA's going to do on the next great adventure.
I feel a little like we're on the dating game. Bachelor number three, Lee Solid. Say hello.
Well, hello. I'm doing some of the same kinds of things that Bob has mentioned here. I'm serving on a review team looking at Ares One. Mm-hmm. It's a standing review board. I'm doing some consulting, and I'm working with the Economic Development Commission on helping mitigate this gap that we always talk about when we lose all of these folks when the shuttle stops flying.
Sure.
And so I'm working with those folks and seeing what we can do to retain high-tech jobs and bring new high-tech jobs to the Space Coast.
Okay. Good. Now, Lee, let's start with you. Let's talk about Apollo 11. I want to hear from each of you kind of what your big-picture memories were of Apollo 11. Where were you on launch day? What was your contribution?
Well, I was the base manager for the Rocketdyne division of Rockwell in those days. We, of course, had the propulsion system. We had the big engines, the F-1 engines on the first stage, the J-2 on the second and third stage. We also had that little ascent engine on the ascent module.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a number of other small engines. In fact, I counted one time that when you count all of the attitude control system and reaction control system thrusters, we had something like 33 engines on that Saturn V stack. And I was the senior exec for the company that had all those engines. Now, where was I on launch day for Apollo 11? I was in firing room 2 in my usual spot. They took me off the council when they made me the base manager.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it well. People want to know, what were you thinking? What maybe new and different?
Right.
I had nothing that I can recall that was new and different. Every mission, you know, it was our total focus during the time we were preparing for the mission. And as an engine guy, we certainly were anxious when it came time to push the button. But that wasn't any different for this one. We just recognized that we were indeed involved in something huge.
Now, there's an old joke about the engine guys at Rocketdyne, at least with the space shuttle, that, you know, your primary qualification for the job is, can you hold your breath for 8.5 minutes?
All right.
Was it kind of like that way, too, with the Saturn?
It was the same way on any engine that I ever was involved with. I worked for that company for 30 years and was involved in a lot of different engines.
The F1 Mammoth, huge. I mean, you can't almost describe it today. I guess I've heard my friend Andy Chaikin quote Arthur Miller said, you know, that was like the F1 was humans talking back to God, you know, which is that powerful, that immense, that incredible. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I don't think that I've ever heard anything louder. And I first started hearing it when it was on the test stand, when we were in the early days of development. And, you know, it got your attention then. And then you put five of them together on the base of the Saturn 1C, and, yes, you knew that something was happening. 1.5 million pounds each, yes, you not only heard it, you felt it.
Incredible. And by the way, I do know it was Norman Mailer. Just want to make sure that's clear before I get all the emails from my parents. Bob Seek, tell me, what were you up to?
Well, I was a journeyman engineer on the command service module, and my title was test team integration engineer, project engineer. And the way we did the test team then was divide up the systems into various disciplines on the spacecraft. You know, there was engineers responsible for telemetry, for propulsion, for a different group for mm-hmm. power, and a different group for environmental control. But when these systems had to play together, which they did for the most part in all of the flow of the hardware at KSC and certainly the launch, you had integrated requirements and integrated procedures. And when those were invoked, that's when the test team integration engineer earned his keep in this case for... For Apollo 11, I was the backup or the substitute. My colleague was the lead for that one. I was busy on Apollo 12.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the atmosphere at the time, we had three vehicles in flow at all times down here during the Apollo program, and that's why there was 25,000 people here.
Right.
Because three missions times three stages plus two payloads per stage, you know, you do the math. There's a lot of work going on. It just happened to be that whoever drew the straw for Apollo 11 for the command module, service module, lunar module, and the stages just happened to be on the Apollo 11 launch team, but there was no distinction between them and the rest of us.
Sure.
Anyway, I looked forward to it because if you were not on the prime launch team, you were advised to stay home on launch day because
okay.
of the expected crunch of the traffic and,
sure.
and all the people here in Brevard County. So that was the only manned Apollo launch that I was able to watch from outdoors as opposed to my little 8-inch black and white TV screen in the ACE control room in the ONC building.
So did you run out to the backyard or were you on one of the causeways or something?
I lived in Titusville and went down to the river with my wife and 1-year-old daughter, and I was going to drive down there. We lived a few miles away in Titusville. Only got halfway there and had to park the car because of the crunch of traffic that was mm-hmm. in Titusville at the time. So we had to walk the rest of the way and fortunately got to the river just a few minutes before launch.
Dick, what about you?
I was a test conductor for the Bendix Corporation. They had the launch support activities, not the flight hardware, but the propellants, the high-pressure mm-hmm. gases, the structures. And one of my jobs was to supervise all the people on my shift. Once we picked up the countdown, they worked for the test conductor. Did not work for their individual managers, so we could integrate all of that activity. And we moved the mobile service structure, we moved the vehicle to the pad, and that night I worked the third shift. I always worked the third shift during launches because I was single and it was easier for me to do that than a lot of the other guys, and I liked that shift. And at 6 in the morning, John Atkins, who was the Kennedy Space Center safety director at that time, asked me if I would go watch the launch and be a safety observer from the top of the VAB roof. And I had, the previous manned launches had responsibility for the impact convoy, which were all the emergency forces that rallied at the roadblock by the LCC in the event that we had an on-pad abort or some kind of accident. So I guess he thought that I would be a good person to look at the landscape, and believe me, you could see the landscape from the top of the VAB roof. It was spectacular.
And they used to have like a, they didn't have a slide wire like shuttle. Didn't they have like a quick chute to go down and then inside into the pad?
Yeah, into the bunker.
Into the bunker.
Yeah, they had a slide wire system, and we still have a slide wire system, as a matter of fact, that gets the flight crew and the closeout crew off the structure.
Bob Sieg, once it got off the ground, real quick here, about a minute to go, tell me, what did you all do at KSC? Do you move on to the next vehicle and let Houston worry about the flight, or did you kind of keep one eye on the TV?
Oh, we always kept an eye on the TV, and particularly this one, you didn't have the visibility you have today during the shuttle mission. Fortunately, there was a radio station in Titusville, much like this one, that whenever there was an Apollo mission in going on, the radio station just cut out of all its normal programming, and it just continuously transmitted the air-to-ground communication between the crew and mission control all during the mission, with the exception of the time the crew was asleep.
Okay, cool. Well, let's talk some more about Apollo memories in a minute here. Barry from Palm Bay, stand by. We see that you're in the queue. We'll take a brief pause here when we come back. More from our friends from the Kennedy Space Center. If you're online, have a question, go ahead, email it to spacetalking@AOL.com. I'm Jim Behnke. This is WMMB. More with Space Talk in just a moment.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke. Call Jim now, 768-1240, or star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers.
Welcome back, everybody, to the second half of this week's edition of Space Talk. I am Jim Behnke, and welcome aboard to this stroll down memory lane again for Apollo 11. And we appreciate your participation. Barry from Palm Bay has a very quick question about, about the International Space Station. What's on your mind, Barry?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Wonderful show, and hello to all your eminent panelists that you have there. You know, as a taxpayer and a fan of the space program, I'm a little bit sorry to see the space shuttle program go away. But what bothers me is we don't have a good, viable program that we control to get people to and from the space station. We have to wait till the Constellation program comes online. I'm curious, what is the cost to send people to the space station in the new program that's coming up, you know, in 5 years, as compared to what it costs us to put them on a Russian rocket to send them up there?
Tough question to answer this early in the program. They're still working on the development of the vehicle. There's still development costs to consider. The operational costs are still kind of out there. The Russians are charging, I think the last number I saw was somewhere around $30 million, $35 million. Per person to send a crew member up on the Soyuz rocket. Whether the cost for Ares 1 or whatever it is we finally decide to go with is going to be comparable to that, you know, yet to determine. The big thing, though, that I think we need to remember is that while we can continue to rely on our Russian partners, this country really needs its own capability to take care of its own folks.
And, I agree with that 100, 150%.
And that's going to be worth whatever cost it is. So, Barry, thanks for that. We need to move on to some more Apollo 11 memories with our guests, Dick Bagley, Bob Sieg, Lee Solid. Lee, talk a little bit, if you would, about what was it like working the launch team, working on the program during these days when, you know, President Kennedy had been assassinated. Was there a personal motivation there to continue? Was this all about his goal, his dream? Was there something else? Was it beating the pants off the Soviets? What was motivating you guys to work so hard?
Well, you know, it probably was all of those things. You know, the leadership in those days were a dynamic group that kept us focused on what we were doing. I mean, there wasn't any doubt in my mind that we were going to accomplish this goal that Kennedy set out for us. And, of course, Apollo 1 was a setback. But it was amazing how they turned that around. But we had leaders like Rocco Patrone. I mean, there was never any doubt as to who was running the show and who you had to satisfy in terms of your day-to-day performance. I mean, I was on a contract to the Marshall Space Flight Center for all of the work that we did on the engines.
Sure.
But the guy that ran the show here was Rocco Patrone, and we knew we had to satisfy him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the leadership was certainly focused. They had a management system in place that made sure that we were focused. And so, like I say, we knew we were involved in something big. They never let us forget that. And so we knew that whatever it was we did, we had to do it in the very best, in the very safest, and the most accomplished way. And so, you know, I don't know how to answer your question other than by saying, hey, we had the kind of leadership that could pull this off.
Dick, we're talking about the Cold War at the time and the whole Soviet intrigue. I remember early on in my career seeing a poster out at the Space Center that had the shuttle on it with an American flag and had the Buran Soviet shuttle on the other side, and it said coincidence. And it was one of the security posters that appeared from time to time out there. Were you aware of Cold War stuff? Were you paying attention to the Soviets? Were you concerned that, you know, how loud people should talk when you're having, you know, lunch at the restaurant in Merritt Island?
Well, I think the Apollo program and then shuttle were two very different programs to think about that concern. Early in shuttle, we flew Department of Defense payloads, and there were a lot of classified activities going on, so we had to be very sensitive to what we were flying in the way of payloads. And so, but I think during Apollo 11, or during the Apollo program, people were so busy. And I can tell you that in those days, everybody looked forward to going to work in the morning because every day was an adventure. And so you didn't get too distracted about other things that were going on when you were working 12 hours, 14 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. And we enjoyed our work so much, we didn't complain about it.
That's great. Hey, Bob, now, of course, you're well known for being a sports racer enthusiast here. I don't know if you did that, picked that up during Apollo or not, but, you know, what was it like during the Apollo days in Brevard County? I mean, I've read somewhere where during Apollo there were more per capita, there were more churches and more bars in Brevard than anywhere else in the United States at the time. Was this a work hard, play hard kind of atmosphere?
Well, a short answer to that would be yes. The you know, a lot of us enjoyed 12-hour shifts, 7 to 7. It was a good week if you got the daylight version of that shift as opposed to the nighttime. But when you got a day off, yeah, play hard. Hobbies were, you know, and other extracurricular activity were the norm. And credit the spouses and those families that were able to deal with that, find the right balance between the work and the family time and stay together, because there were certainly a lot of pressures to go off on the proverbial tangent.
Was the Apollo 11 splashdown party of particular note?
It was, you know, actually no different than any of the others, because as you looked at it, particularly leading up to Apollo 11, every mission was different. I mean, we celebrated a lot on Apollo 8 when they lit the engine on a command service module and got out of lunar orbit.
Sure.
We celebrated a lot on Apollo 9 when they checked out the lunar module for the first time in space, and Apollo 10 whenever they connected in lunar orbit and then disconnected and got back home safely. Every mission was unique, and as a result, there was really no distinction about Apollo 11, and except in that one, you know, the descent stage on a lunar module was going to take them all the way to the surface of the moon. Obviously, we celebrated with every splashdown, but you look at the missions preceding that, they had just as much risk as Apollo 11.
Yeah. Lee, you're talking about the hard work going on at the Cape and the long days, the long hours, and the support from the family. It's been said that you guys were all working so hard that it was hard to either pay attention or even being aware of what was going on in the rest of the nation at the time. We had Al Warden on from Apollo 15 last week, and he said that from his perspective, he was a little aware of the assassinations and the riots and the tough times that were the 1960s here in our nation, but he was very much detached from it. And it was always kind of a weird deal that you had all these incredible miracles of technology happening. And was that the experience at Kennedy Space Center? Was that experience in Brevard during that time?
Oh, I think so. I think you captured it. We knew that all these other things were going on, but, you know, we were so focused on this mission that we had that, you know, you looked past that, and you know, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about it or agonizing over it, simply because of the focus. I've never, in my whole career, I've never been involved in anything that was as focused as this was. And, of course, you know, we had to work at doing things. I had a young family, and I wanted to make sure that I went to the Little League games, and I did all those kinds of things. And you just had to work a little harder at doing the things that you needed to do outside of work. And so I think that, you know, generally speaking, having a mission and a vision like we had, you know, is translatable to just about anything else if you choose to set things up that way. We don't do it anymore, but that was sort of a one of a kind.
We've got a call coming in, Jim from West Melbourne, about the moon. Jim, just got about 30 seconds to chat. What's on your mind? And Jim's gone. We'll try it one more time. Aaron, is he going to be there?
No, sorry about that, Jim.
Nope, okay, we dumped him. All right, yeah. So Dick, real quick, as we head into one of our final breaks here, and I'm always reluctant to talk about this because I know when people ask me about Challenger and Columbia, it's hard to talk about for me because I lived through those experiences directly. I know that you were involved with Apollo 1. All of you were, but I know that you were in the blockhouse that day. Not so much about Apollo 1 that day, but in the aftermath. Could we have made it to the moon by the end of 1969 if it weren't for what you learned from Apollo 1?
Well, I think I can't remember which of the astronauts the other day at the ceremony mentioned the fact that the fire probably helped the program look at all of the issues that needed to be dealt with to make the program more efficient and safer. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And what would have happened had we not had the accident? I don't think anybody knows. But it certainly got a lot of people's attention, and there were a lot of corrective actions taken and design changes made.
And Bob Seek, you said earlier you were working closer with the command module and all that. How complicated was that thing ultimately? I mean, you know, was it the most advanced flying machine to its day?
Well, it certainly looked that way to us as the journeyman engineers. And in fact, you look back on the program, particularly relative to what the teams have to deal with today in putting humans into space, it was the only real hurdle back then was technology. Because you had empowerment from management, you had ultimate resources. We were told, we're not letting money get in the way, we're going to the moon, whatever you need, just ask for it, we'll get it. If you made mistakes, management was supportive and wanted to know, assuming you didn't do something irresponsible, do you need more training, better tools, is there a problem with the procedures, we're going to the moon, we want to do it right, and oh, by the way, we're going to get there before the Russians.
Yeah, and that was the goal, wasn't it? Well, we're going to pause for just kind of a final two-minute break here. When we come back, some final thoughts about the future of human spaceflight from our guests from the Kennedy Space Center. But for now, I'm Jim Behnke. This is Space Talk on WMB. Stay tuned.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240 and star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to our final segment of the day on Space Talk. Still some more to cover here with our guests from the Kennedy Space Center, Dick Begley, Bob Seek, and Lee Sala. Real quick, Jim had called in earlier, and we did get his question. He wanted to know if the moon rotates, and it absolutely does rotate. In fact, it rotates at the exact same speed that it circles the Earth. And so that's why we always see the same exact side of the moon facing us all the time. It's not that it's not rotating. It's just that it's moving at the same speed as it's orbiting. Kind of one of those weird tricks that God has played on us. That does not mean, however, that there is a dark side to the moon. And so many people say there's a bright side and a dark side. What everyone thinks of as the dark side is more properly called the far side. And the far side of the moon gets just as much light as the near side does over the course of every month. And so that's the quick 101 on lunar orbital mechanics for you today. And you didn't even probably get a headache learning that. So, cool. Moving on. Let's wrap it up with our guests here. And Lee Solid, you're working on Constellation and talking about things happening after Shuttle. And the big concern for our local economy, anyway, is the gap. And I think it's a big concern in terms of spaceflight operations. That time from when Shuttle retires to that next capability to send humans into space from Florida, or for that matter, anywhere else, but I think it's going to come from Florida. You lived through the first gap that we had after Apollo Soyuz in 1975 and the first Shuttle launch in 1981. What's the deal on the gap? What's going to happen? What's the possibilities? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one of the pluses with what we're facing today from what we faced post-Apollo is that, you know, the workforce out here is not near as large, so the cutbacks won't be near as extensive. Also, you know, the county had a population of something like 250,000 in 1971, and it's now somewhere around 550,000. So there's the capability to absorb some of the loss that we're going to face when mm-hmm. Shuttle flies out. And so, you know, the circumstances are a little bit different, but, you know, the number's 3,500, and now people are talking 4,500 that might be hitting the street when the shuttle stops flying. You know, interestingly enough, the shuttle being a reusable system is a manpower-intensive system to maintain, and mm-hmm. the systems we're looking at replacing it aren't. They're expendables. But I appreciate the fact that we have agencies that are dedicated to retaining as much as we can the workforce, this high-skilled workforce, and even bring in new jobs here. And we've had some success in doing that, by the way. But we have the Economic Development Commission, we have Space Florida, we have the Brevard Workforce Board, we have Enterprise Florida. Mm-hmm. We've got a number of agencies that are hard at work in helping to solve this problem.
Bob Seek, a question for you that you get to answer in only 30 seconds, because I know it would take hours and hours to fully explore this, but, you know, the meaning of Apollo to you and to your colleagues after it's all been said and done on this 40th anniversary.
It reminds me that technically our nation can do anything it has the commitment to do, given it's given the resources to do it. You know, there's no challenge too great. The products of our education systems today, they're very intelligent young men and women. They can do the same things. They're smarter than we were when we got out of college many decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
It just, there has to be the commitment of the resources to do it, and we should remind ourselves what President Kennedy said when we started out on the great adventure back in the 60s, that we choose to do it because it's hard, not because it's easy, but right. we'll be better for it. And the other was, in that environment, was the acceptance of risk. We're more risk-averse today. Back then, risk was more acceptable, and I would use my favorite quote from Amelia Earhart that determine first if the goal is worth the risk. If mm-hmm. it is, stop worrying and go do it.
And go do it. I miss the days, not that I was alive for them, when you could slap a piece of duct tape on a problem, and that was it. You didn't need a committee and an oversight panel and a quality control board and another $100 million. Okay, none of them are really reacting to that as appropriate. Dick Bagley, looking ahead, we all know why we should continue. We're all advocates, but what's it going to take to continue this program in the future? And, you know, where might we be heading next?
Well, I think the leadership in this country has got to instill the spirit of exploration similar to what they did when John Kennedy kicked off the Apollo program and the Lunar Landing Challenge. Without that, the funding won't happen to the extent that it needs to happen. And in my mind, that's the key to this. The technology is available. The funding has got to be secured so that the workforce gets motivated properly and we get on with it just like we did with Apollo.
Good. Thanks, Dick. Those are good words. And good words to wrap up our interview with the three of you gentlemen. Thank you each, Dick Bagley, Bob Seek, Lee Solid, for being here. You all three are mentors to me, and I appreciate our relationship, personal and professional, and thanks for being here today. As we kind of start closing out our edition of Space Talk today, I want to call your attention to the fact that this is the Apollo 11 anniversary week, and one of my favorite things to do is to keep an eye on what's going on. We're certainly doing our part on radio. On television for the next few days, oh my gosh, there is so much to watch and soak up in terms of the memories and the pictures and the stories. And if you didn't live during Apollo, you got a lot to learn, and now is a good time to do it. I want to call your attention to the fact that the History Channel at 9 o'clock on Monday got a program called Moonshot. Then they're going to do an episode of As It Happened, all related to Apollo 11. That's going to continue and be repeated. Also that same day on the Turner Classic Movie Channel, TCM, they're running a space marathon. And I've only got time to list the movies. They Came from Beyond Space, From the Earth to the Moon, Jules Verne's version of it, H.G. Wells' version of First Men in the Moon from 1964, 12 to the Moon from 1960, the ultimate classic, 1950s Destination Moon, is going to be on in the afternoon. An unusual film called The Mouse on the Moon, The Three Stooges Have Rocket Will Travel is going to be on. Disney's Moon Pilot's going to be on. A 15-minute silent film called A Trip to the Moon. Al Reinhardt's 1989 movie For All Mankind is going to be on. The old favorite, The Right Stuff, which you just have to watch with your tongue in cheek. The must-see movie is Marooned, based on the book by my dear friend, the late Martin Caden, is going to be on. Incredible pictures in that movie of the Cape back in the 1960s. That's the one where they go rescue the Apollo capsule by launching through the eye of a hurricane. You can't miss it. And finally, you can sleep through this one on Tuesday morning, Capricorn 1. We won't need to say anything more about that one. So it's going to be a lot of fun watching these specials. I think there's going to be some locally produced specials. And, of course, we've already heard some things about Walter Cronkite that they're going to air. CBS is doing something. And just because of the strong link he had to the space program, there should be some really neat footage of him covering all of those incredible moments. So next week we're wrapping up our remembrance of Apollo 11 with author Andy Chaikin. We're going to have a couple of surprise guests phoning in, and I'm going to tell my own story about what I was up to during Apollo 11's launch, landing, and splashdown. Clear memories that I have of those events when I was growing up in Minnesota. Well, that's it for today. Thanks to all for listening. I hope that you stay tuned to Endeavor coverage this week on WMMB. And for now, this is Space Talk with Jim Banky. You are listening to WMMB. Have a good week.